everybody. My name's Don Popejoy. I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace, sponsorship, and the 12 steps, I've been sober since February 21st, 1980. I'm so grateful for my sobriety and so grateful to be here with you this weekend and this Sunday morning. My home group is the primary purpose group on Marco Island, Florida. We have a Naples address, but we live a lot closer to Marco Island. And you might reasonably wonder why your program shows me being from Wichita, why my name tag shows me being from Wichita. I'm a Kansas Jayhawker. I was born in Kansas, grew up in Kansas, got married in Kansas. We had our two kids in Kansas. My wife, Susan, grew up in Topeka. We met in college. She's a 25-year committed member and active member of the Al-Anon family groups. Did a lot of my drinking in Kansas. Got 12-stepped in Kansas by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So went to AA in Kansas, got sober there. Had my sponsors there until 2003. But we lived in a little town out in southwestern Kansas by the name of Ulysses, out in the High Plains. The windswept High Plains of southwestern Kansas. I ran into a guy about 20 minutes before the meeting that grew up 30 miles from me. We've known each other a long time. It's a small world in AA. I ended up being in the construction business there, and in 1996, we sold the majority of our business to a company in Wichita and moved to Wichita. Lived there until November of 2004 when I quit working, retired, and we called a moving truck and loaded up our stuff for the land of perpetual sunshine, Cadillacs, and cataracts. And here we came to Southwest Florida. I think about the time Lee called me to invite me to come down here and speak at your roundup, we still had a Wichita mailing address, so AA didn't lie to you. It's used to be Wichita, now it's Naples. I want to thank Lee for inviting me to come be with you this weekend. I want to thank all of the service committee that puts on this terrific roundup. I want to thank Tom for repeatedly convincing the hotel it was okay for me to eat here. I want to thank John for graciously serving as my host and for all of the service workers that have been responsible for this great weekend for me. I want to thank the speakers. There isn't anybody sitting here this morning that has been here this weekend. From that guy last night that's been here 4 days to the guy last night that's been here 45 years that needed to be here this weekend any more than your Sunday morning speaker. And I really didn't know that till Friday afternoon. And I hope I have the presence of mind in a little while to share with you what that's all about. We started out Thursday night with Frances, and I loved her story. And something about the idea of she kept trying to throw those groceries over the side of the boat, and she never did make it. They always fell down in the pond, and her son would have to snorkel after the groceries. That reminded me so much of my efforts in the first 41 years of my life before I got to you. It was like I was always almost getting it right, but never quite right. And then Friday, Bob did the steps in a way that I've just never heard them done before, and said something Friday afternoon that he may or may not have been aware of that was the whole reason why I've been here with you. And Friday night, Sharon, I've been listening to her talk and things like this since I almost 26 years now. And she, I think, maybe more than anybody who speaks in AA, with one or two possible exceptions, opens her heart in a way that touches my heart that's just so special. And then I never had been privileged to hear Casey until Saturday morning, and It opened my heart and made it so raw. What was so special to me is the honor and the tribute that he paid to those that were his running and drinking companions that couldn't get here. And how Alcoholics Anonymous, we pay honor to them as to well of those of us that have been so incredibly fortunate as to receive this miracle of sobriety. And then Kathy is just one of my three most favorite Al-Anon speakers, and I thank her for sharing her story, and particularly this wonderful love story that's happened in her life. And every time that Kathy shares, I just feel like I'm so current with what's going on with her. And then last night, Bob, God, I've been hearing Bob in person and on tape since early sobriety, and he's had a real impact on my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's never been my sponsor, but in many ways that I don't think he's even aware of, he's been my mentor. And he shared last night with an insight that just blows me away. So I'm grateful to all the speakers. I know that it's my responsibility, and the reason I'm here now is to share with you in a general way what happened to me and what I used to be like and what I'm like today. I don't know about you when you share. For me, it's always been easy to talk about what my behavior used to be like when I was drinking. It's always been much more difficult for me to really find words to express how I was like on the inside. I still struggle with that. It's like there was always something missing in Don. I think if someone would have taken my photograph and pasted it onto some cardboard and cut it up with a jigsaw and made a picture puzzle of my life, and then you tried to put it together, there'd have been this missing piece right in the middle of Don. There was always something missing in here. And in retrospect, from this quarter century of a sober life in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I look back at the first 41 years of my life, I think from the time I was a little boy until I got to you in 1980, what my life was really about was the futile struggle of trying to find what in the hell was missing in me. Why did I have this hole in the middle of me? And I just tried all kinds of things to fill in the missing piece of Don. My sophomore year in high school, I had three first-time experiences that I thought were the answer to the puzzle of my life. I thought each of these experiences provided me the missing piece. Reasonably early that year, I just have always loved airplanes, and I convinced my dad to let me take flying lessons, and for the first time, I got to fly an airplane by myself, and I thought, life, this is what I've been missing in life, this absolute euphoria that always has come over me when I get to be up in the sky in an airplane and, like the poem says, kiss the face of God. And it was wonderful. And then a little later that year, I was a senior girl invited me to be her date to the junior-senior prom. And about 3 or 4 o'clock the next morning on a dirt road in Grant County, Kansas, in the back of my dad's 54 Ford, I was absolutely certain that I had discovered the missing piece in my life. That didn't last too long, this is Sunday morning. I need to remind. And that summer, my folks had gone to Colorado on a fishing trip, and I'd talked Dad out of a bar in that 54 Ford to take some of my buddies to the drive-in theater. And this really dates me, I know. My hair dates me. It's, you know, my face dates me. I'm old. We'll get that out of the way. And we got to the drive-in, and one of those guys in the back seat said, "Look what I've got." And he pulled out a pint of tequila. Now, I had made myself a promise a long, long time before now that because of the heartache and the heartbreak, the broken promises, the fear, that permeated our home because of my dad's drinking that I wouldn't ever drink. And that I would never subject the people that love me to the things that my dad's drinking subjected us to in our house. So I promised I would never drink. And this guy in the back seat took a drink out of this thing, handed it to the guy over on my right side, and he took a drink out of it and handed it to me. And without one thought of any of that, I picked that thing up and drank the biggest swallow I could get down. And I thought I was going to die. It burned, and I choked, and I spewed and spit. And when I handed that bottle to the guy behind me in the back seat, I remember this so clearly. The only thought that went through my head is, I hope to God there's some of that stuff left when it gets back around to me. And I think that's exactly how long my career lasted as a social drinker. And I knew when that bottle came back around, without any shadow of doubt, that I'd found what had been missing in my life for 17 years. Because that's how old it was. And so as I look back now over my life, it seems like from then until I was 41, when I got to you in these rooms of AA, what I was really about was trying in some form or another to take those three things, you know, lots of times flying and sex and booze, and somehow stuff and cram them into this hole in my middle to try to make me whole, to try to make me complete. I'd try all kinds of goofy stuff, not just those three things, to try to fill in what was missing in me. I don't know about you, but I was a bar drinker till the end. Till the end, I'd hole up in a hotel room. But most of the time, I was a bar drinker. And I like to drink in places where the smoke's so thick you can cut it with a knife, and you can hear those ice cubes tinkling in the glasses. And there's a country and western band back in the corner in a little 6x8 dance floor. And you can go back there and polish belt buckles. And, you know, that's my kind of a place. And I had all these closing time fantasies about how wonderful it was going to be after the belt buckle polishing was over. You know? And my closing time fantasies just never came true. We've heard a lot this weekend from various speakers about being unable, because of the illness of alcoholism, to accept life on life's terms. And that was where I was, but I had no idea that was what was going on with me. I mean, the simple truth of the matter is, they don't like to go home with you if you're puking on their boots. That's all there is to that. But I couldn't accept that. I couldn't accept that. And I took a look at myself in the mirror, and I said, what's wrong with me? Why doesn't closing time turn out right? And the reality jumped out and hit me. I've been this ball-headed since I was 24 years old. And I immediately realized that my problem in life was the fact that I was prematurely ball-headed, and I had to do something about fixing that. That was the missing piece. So I heard about this doctor in Wichita, and I got my little airplane, and I flew to Wichita, and made an appointment with him. I parked in front of a liquor store and a barbershop, walked across the street. He had an upstairs office, and he explained to me that for $5,000, he could cut 10 rows of holes in the top of my head. And he could cut about 50 plugs of hair out of the back of my neck and stick those plugs of hair into the rows in the top of my head. And if we got real lucky, grow me 10 corn rows of hair. And he thought that would fill in the missing piece. And he said, what do you think? And I said, not much. He said, why? And I said, well, $5,000, this was in 1970 or so, and I said, $5,000 is a ridiculous amount of money, and I'm not into pain, and besides that, you're as ball-headed as I am. If it works a dadgum good, why don't you do it yourself? You know? And he said, well, I don't think it bothers me that much to be ball-headed. And I said, I don't think it does me either. And so I paid for my appointment. I walked across the street, bought a fifth of J&B Scotch because there was a place I was planning on going. And I looked up, and the easier, softer way just jumped up and hit me right square in the eyeballs. This barbershop was not just a men's barbershop. It was a man's wig store. And in the window of that barbershop were about 10 models, styrofoam models of men's heads, and on each one of those heads was a full head of hair. And I walked in there and gave that guy $300 and came out an hour and a half later looking just like one of my heroes, a country and western singer named Glenn Campbell. I had a pompadour that went from here to here. there was a challenge involved in this. And the challenge always, if you have a head like mine and a rug, is how are you going to get the rug to stick on the shiny bald head? And their solution was they sold me a roll of double-sided adhesive tape. And I cut this tape into little one-inch strips and pulled the backing off of one side of the tape and stick the sticky side down around the inside perimeter of the wig. Now I got the sticky side down, and now I peeled the backing off the other side of the tape. Now I got a sticky side down, a sticky side up, and you stick that thing on your head and comb it in and spray some stuff on it, and you're ready to go do the boogaloo. And I think that probably works reasonably well for non-alcoholic drinkers. I mean, adhesive tape abhors perspiration. And when you pour scotch into my belly about 30 minutes later, I mean, some predictable things happen when I pour old J&B's magic elixir down in here. It burns a little bit, and all of a sudden, I mean, I change. I become socially lubricated. I'm the world's best conversationalist. It's hard for me to dance sober. But when you pour that stuff in my belly, there's nobody can dance like I can. And about 30 minutes later, it's going to start coming out the top of my head in the form of sweat. And so here I am. I got my new rug on. I got my fifth of J&B. I jump in my rental car, go down to South Seneca to this place that has that country and western band, the Smokes, the Thickies, all that stuff. And I start drinking and I start dancing and I'm having the time of my life. And I know I found the missing piece. And my head starts sweating. And pretty soon, out there on the dance floor, that old rug turns loose and turns around sideways, right on the top of my head. And it's hard to be a cool operator in a 70s country and western singles bar when the part on your head's running from ear to ear. Pompadour's hanging down over your right earlobe. And closing time was still a disaster. I parted company with that rug a year or two later in a cheap hotel room in Alamosa, Colorado. I was out there working on the airport. And sometimes it wouldn't totally come loose. Sometimes just one side would come loose and it would flop over and you'd have that cool half scalp look. And that's what happened that night. And I made it back to the motel and the thing was hanging down on the side. And all of a sudden it was time for me to make my oblations before the throne of American standards. Some of you have probably been there. And man, I hit my knees and the stuff came up and the other piece or two of tape turned loose and the rug fell down there in the bowl with the rest of it. And it was ugly. And I might have been the village drunk, but I sure wasn't the town idiot. I didn't fish it out. I hit the silver handle and waved goodbye to the whole ugly mess and went back to the only thing that really ever had any success in temporarily filling in the hole in my life, and that was booze. The next 8 or 10 years, my first sponsor used to say that alcoholism put a ring through my nose and took me wherever it wanted to take me, and that's what alcoholism did to me. In the progression of my active alcoholism between then and 1980, I developed a credo for living that went something like this. It said, any means justifies the end. Whatever it was that I perceived I needed to make me happy, to try to fill in what I felt like was missing in my life, it was okay to go about getting it no matter what. Any means justified the ends. If I thought I needed more money to make me happy, I went about the business of getting more money. And if that meant I had to violate the way the law said I was supposed to do business, I didn't hesitate to do that. If I thought I needed more love or sex to make me happy, I went about the business of finding it. And Susan and I had been married for quite a while. And I brought the terrible affliction of infidelity into our marriage and killed it. When I got here, we were married in name only because of my behavior. My behavior became absolutely shameful. I was ashamed of it then. I'm ashamed of it now. I don't wallow in guilt about it now because of the house cleaning steps of AA. I have made amends for what I've done, and I don't live that way anymore by God's grace. But it was shameful. I became a liar and a cheat and a thief in every area of my life. Became a part-time husband, an absentee father. We had two kids, Steve and Linda. And that's the way it was in the early winter of 1980. Susan, out of frustration, had started a business. She became a photographer. She had a lady working for her named Joyce. I like Joyce. Her husband, John, worked with me in the construction business. Joyce and John would come over to the house, and Joyce and I would always fix the drinks. Because we'd go out in the kitchen and have two shooters and fix four mixed drinks and take them out, and John and Susan would let the ice cubes melt, and Joyce and I would chug ours and go back in the kitchen and have two shooters and fix four more drinks, go drink theirs, drink ours, and, you know. I like to drink with Joyce. Sometime before Susan had, I'd come home from one of those weekends, you know. God, I wish I'd heard Francis before I got to AA, this I don't know business. I'd come home from being missing for a couple of weeks, you know. And she'd say, where have you been? And I'd always try to come up with some story to explain it all. If I could have just said, I don't know, what a simpler life would have been. But she had, I'd come home and all the clothes were in the front yard, and that happens sometimes in our house. I don't know about yours. And she said, we're going to go see a marriage counselor. So for several years, a couple of years, we'd fly once. We didn't want anybody to know there's anything wrong in Camelot. So we'd get an airplane, leave that little town, fly to Wichita, see this marriage counselor. And one time he said to me, does your drinking cause trouble at home? And I said, are you an idiot? You listen to her for an hour every week. I think what he said is, then why do you drink? But I can't accept, I hear what I want to hear without you. And what I heard him say is, why do you drink at home? So I started a business in Denver so I could run away to Denver and drink. And, of course, I drank up that business, and it cost me a lot of money. But that's what was going on in 1980, and I was in my office getting ready to pack my stuff up and go to Denver and do what I do in Denver, which is live a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of life. And stay drunk for 3 or 4 days, and then I'd shake it out, and I'd come home and take out my guilt and shame and remorse on Susan and the kids. That was how I was living in 1980. And the phone rang, and it was Susan. She said, Joyce and I want to go to Denver with you. Now, normally, that wouldn't have bothered me too much that Joyce wanted to go, because I like the way Joyce drank. But Joyce, on New Year's Eve, had done a really dumb thing. She'd gotten real drunk and tried to kill herself. She was unsuccessful. But then she'd really done a dumb thing. She started going to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, here I am, living a life of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in Denver. I don't want Susan to go. I don't want Joyce to go because she's in AA, and I should have been able to think of 100 reasons in a New York minute why they couldn't go, and all I said was, okay, I'll meet you at the airport. And as I look back, I think this was clearly, I was getting to the end of my rope because I would have never before have said that they could go. And we got in the plane and flew to Denver, checked into the hotel where I kept a room rented, and I went to the bar. They went to do whatever they came to Denver to do, and that's the last thing I remember about the 20th day of February 1980. I came to the next morning. I recognized the room, but I knew things were bad wrong because Susan was there. And I still had on the shirt and a pair of pants that I'd had on the night before, and about that time Susan woke up and ordered some coffee. And I guess she called Joyce and asked her to come down to the room and have coffee, because I'm sitting there with both hands wrapped around the coffee cup, shaking so bad I can't, pouring it down my shirt, because I can't get it to my mouth. And Joyce, the door, heard a knock on the door. Susan opened the door, and Joyce came bounding into the room with her bright little clear AA eyes. She said, "Good morning, Donald. How are you?" We hear about moments of truth from AA speakers, and this is your Sunday morning speaker's wimpy moment of truth. I just ran out of lies. For the first time, I just ran out of lies, and I looked at Joyce and I said, "I'm not worth a damn." Speaker, there used to be a speaker from Texas. He died some years ago. His name was Joe Leith. Maybe some of you heard him. Joe used to say, he used to talk about the five little magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "It's I know how you feel. I know how you feel." And that's what Joyce said to me. She said, "I know how you feel." God sent me an angel. And he sent her on a cloud because it started snowing right then. And we couldn't fly home. And for the rest of that day and that night and the next morning, Joyce told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. She talked about her drinking and about how she thought she'd found this way up and out. Now let me tell you about Joyce. She was 6 weeks sober. And for those of you that stood up last night in your first year of sobriety, don't think you got to be sober a long time to carry the message of hope and recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous to another suffering alcoholic. If that was true, you'd have a different speaker. She said to me exactly what I needed to hear. And she got me to do something kind of silly. She got me to commit to going with her to a meeting of AA. I had no intention of doing that. I thought surely the screws will back off a little bit and Susan will get over being so mad and Joyce will forget all about that I said that I'd do that. But the weather cleared up and we flew home and I was still in the doghouse and I was out in the kitchen helping with the dishes, and I didn't help with dishes in our house. And the doorbell rang and I was in my shirt sleeves. It was cold. God, snow was on the ground. You know, late February in western Kansas. And I opened the door and there stood Joyce. Joyce was a big, strapping farm girl. And I said, "Joyce, what are you doing here?" And she said, "You promised me we'd go to an AA, you'd go to an AA meeting with me." And I said, "Well, God, I didn't mean tonight. I, you know, something." And she grabbed me right by the collar of my shirt and drugged me out the door and gave me a loving invitation to join you in Alcoholics Anonymous. What she actually said was, "Get your miserable ass in the car. We're going to A&A. And the really strange part of this story is that I've been coming back ever since. God, I loved AA. They had a guy that met you at the door. I mean, I was dealing with bouncers throwing me out the door, places where I was going. They had a guy that met me at the door, shook my hand, said, "Welcome. Have a cup of coffee. The spot's right over there. And come sit down over here by me." I never heard people share about themselves like that, and I identified with you. They just wouldn't get off this idea that I had to ask this guy, somebody, to be my sponsor. I mean, she'd come get me and take me. We had five meetings a week, a little town, 3,000 people. We had five AA meetings a week. She'd come get me. We'd go to those meetings, and they'd say, "Have you asked somebody to be your sponsor?" So to get them off my back, I asked this guy that I knew a little bit about in the group to be my sponsor. I had a lot of respect for him. He was a man of small stature, and I had sat for years before, in my early years, in the beer bars in Ulysses, Kansas. And let me tell you, how you got to buy beer in Ulysses was not how old you were, but were you tall enough to get your quarter on the bar? That was how you bought a beer. And I'd watched Louis fight guys twice his size and whip them for a long time. And then for some reason I knew he quit drinking, but I didn't know what that was all about. So I thought, he's a cool guy. I asked him to be my sponsor. So I asked this guy named Louis to be my sponsor. And he would come by and pick me up and give me assignments in this book that you sold me to read. And then we'd talk about him. And, of course, what he was doing was taking me through the beginning of this process that has just indelibly changed my life, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd come and get me, and we'd talk about what he had assigned to me to read, and we'd talk about the steps. And we'd go to the five meetings of our group every week, and the other two nights we'd go to a nearby town, a little farm. There was lots of little towns out there that had AA groups. And of course, we went through the first three steps, and I didn't find any great difficulty with those, and I still loved AA. And He said, now it's time to write your four-step inventory. And I carefully explained to him that construction season was getting ready to start. And that was my busy time of the year, and this would have to wait till sometime next winter for me to do this. And he showed up the next day in my office, and he threw down a yellow Big Chief pad of yellow notepaper and three number two pencils. And I said, what's this for? And he said, write until you run out of paper or you run out of pencil lead and be at my house Friday night. And I said, oh, I can't do this. And he said, well, then you're going to have to get somebody else to be your sponsor. So he blackmailed me into writing my first inventory. Thank God. Thank God. Because this guy, I just never been around anybody like him. He was the most spiritual, best human being I believe I'd ever been around. I didn't want to lose his friendship. So I sat down and wrote this inventory and showed up at his house and had no idea what we were going to do with it. I had a little idea. I'd read ahead. I like to read ahead. Bob talked about in his step study, you hear voices in AA today that place great emphasis on the mechanics of step four and the rest of the steps. If you had to write an inventory, and if in order to stay sober, this is my experience, if in order for me to stay sober, I had to write an inventory that began with drawing three lines on a piece of paper and making a list of the people I was resentful at and why I was resentful at them and what had affected my life, and then later what my part in that was, and write down all of my fears, I would not be sober today, because I couldn't do it that way. I just couldn't do it that way. I wrote the immoral litany of my life. I wrote about every bad and wrong thing that I had ever done. I've written a lot of inventory. I come from a place in AA where they really push written 10th step inventories on an annual basis. So I've written a lot of inventory in these years. And I've tried doing it just the way it says in the big book, and I have no objection with that. That's not the way I do it today. I think Bob talked about his wife Linda in Al-Anon about this pie. And I had a sponsor for 18 years that suggested that I do this. And when I write inventory today, I write about what's happened to me since my last written inventory. And I break down into the areas of my life. My married life, my life with my kids, my financial situation, my life in AA, my service commitments, my life outside of AA, and my job, when I used to have a job. And I found that that works well, and that's not precisely how the big book says to do it. I would never put down anything in the big book, but I think it says in the big book at the start of that process that we did something like this. We did something like this. It's my experience that what's important in the steps are not the mechanics of the steps, but the dynamic of the steps, the action that I take as a result of these 12 steps. And I think it's this action that's changed my life. So we got to Louis' house, and he said, he opened this book up, and he said, let's get down on our knees. And you heard that from someone else at this conference. And that's just the way they did it. And I thought it was strange, but we got on our knees, and he opened the book up to the third step prayer, and we said the third step prayer. And I handed him this thing that I'd written, and he handed it back. And he said, here's step five. You wrote it. You read it. I'll listen, and God is here. So I started reading about all this crap in my life that I had done. And I was not halfway through with that, and he said, Don, stop for a minute. And I looked up, and there were tears running down his face. And I thought, you know, what's happened here is that I have so offended him writing about my behavior, that he's going to ask me to leave. That's what I really thought. And I said, what is it, Louis? And he said, do you realize you're telling me the story of my life? Twelve and Twelve talks about this point of the journey being the beginning of the end of isolation. A little spark of willingness to change was born right then, because I thought, my God, if he can get from what I've just written about to where he's at, maybe there's a little hope for me. So I read the rest of that, and then we got down on our knees and said the seventh step prayer. And then he said, we need to take out another clean sheet of yellow paper. And that's when my love affair with AA ended. Because I had read ahead and I knew that we were going to make my amends list. And I said, Louis, I can't do this. I can't clean this mess up. And that wasn't the truth. I didn't tell him the truth. His sponsor was a guy named Jerry, who ended up being my sponsor for 18 years. Jerry was an ex-professional rodeo cowboy. And he had all these little cornball sayings that he was always throwing out in AA meetings. And we'd talk, they'd be having a step study on step 8 or 9, and Jerry'd usually say, he just almost always would say, a guy told me that if I decided I was going to have to do something about my drinking, if I was a drunken horse thief, and it was, I felt like I was going to have to do something about my drinking, I was probably first have to going to quit stealing horses. And the truth of the matter was, is that night in Louis' house, I didn't think I was willing. I didn't think I wanted to change and quit stealing the horses in my life. The horses of lying, cheating, and stealing. He must have perceived that because he said, Don, there's good news and bad news for you. He said, the good news is I think you can get sober and stay sober in AA. And the bad news is I think if you keep living your life, if you keep breaking your marriage vows the way you're doing it with your infidelity, if you keep doing illegal business practices, if you keep treating your family the way you're treating them, if you keep treating your kids the way you're treating them, he said, I don't think you got a snowball's chance of hell of staying sober. And it was late. He'd help me dig out of this inventory all the resentments I had at my dad, who'd been dead for 12 years, and my mother, who was still living, and my wife, and my kids, my brother, and my family. Just all these resentments I was eating up with. And I said, well, I'll give this a try. And I went home. And you know, the big book says when after we do our fifth step, we go home, we take our book down from the shelf, we carefully examine ourselves to see if we've been thorough in our work so far. Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And that's not exactly what I did. I went home and wrote a letter of resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth of the matter is, I wrote it because I didn't think I wanted to quit stealing the horses in my life. Louis had cajoled Susan and I into agreeing to go with a bunch of them from the Ulysses group of AA and Al-Anon, the Al-Anon group, to a little conference down in a branch of the Paladura Canyon south of Amarillo, Texas. The conference name is Cedar Canyon Conference. The place is called Cedar Glen. And kind of to get him off our backs, we had agreed to go. Susan had started going to Al-Anon by this time. And we had agreed to go. You know, the fact that Susan goes to Al-Anon, she's been a member of Al-Anon since March 17, 1980. That was her first meeting. And my recovery does not depend upon Susan being a committed, active member of Al-Anon. But I tell you with every fiber of my being that my sobriety is so enhanced because she is. I love the Al-Anon family groups. I love what it's brought to our relationship, how it has been so vitally important in our family. And I am now and will eternally be grateful for the Al-Anon family groups and for the fact that Susan's a member. I mean, the big book tells me that I got to burn into my consciousness the idea that the only requirement for me getting sober and staying sober is to trust God, clean house, and help others. And I know that's true. But Al-Anon's been a tremendous help to us. So we went down to this little conference, and we heard a guy named Johnny A. from California talk that night. It's funny how things work out. The guy who's my sponsor now is sponsored by Johnny A. And after the meeting, this big guy from the group came up that I'd known almost all my life. He's a little younger than I am, but he was sober for 3 years. His name's Bernie. He grabbed me by the arm and said, I have to talk to you. And I said, why? And he said, well, let's go sit down near this tree and we'll talk. And what he told me was that many years before he had stolen something from me that I didn't know anything about, and he was afraid he was going to get drunk if he didn't make amends to me. And I said, Bernie, I don't want your money. And he said, you don't get it, Don. This isn't about you. It's about me. I have to do this to stay sober. And light came on. And I thought, my God, you guys really do this thing. And and I looked in Bernie and I saw something that I'd never seen in my eyes, and that was peace. So I said, I'll take your money if it's that important. And I saw this sense of peace. And I wanted what he had. I wanted what he had. I wanted what he had more than I wanted to keep stealing those damned horses. So I went over to my sponsor's bunk and in a bunkhouse, and these were crude facilities that we had in those days at Cedar Canyon. And said, Lou, you're never going to believe what happened a little bit ago. And I thought he was clairvoyant, that he was also Bernie's sponsor. He said, I think I have an idea. I said, I've got to tell you why I came down here. He said, why? I said, I came down here to read you this letter of resignation that I wrote to AA. And he started laughing. And he said, you still want to read it? And I said, no. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to try cleaning up this deal. I said, I don't know if I can, but I want what Bernie's got. So he said, okay, we're going to start at home. And I said, Louis, you heard what I wrote about what things are like at home. But there's no life behind the closed door of our bedroom. And he said, Don, it may surprise you to learn that good sex oftentimes begins in the kitchen. And I said, it may surprise you to learn that there's not a snowball's chance in hell Susan's ever going to go along with that idea. And he explained to me that was not what he meant. And he told me I had to quit being a part-time husband and an absentee father, that I had to go to Susan and the kids and tell them that I had wronged them. He told me, he said, Don, for you, making amends doesn't have hardly anything to do with saying I'm sorry. He said, you're the world's expert at saying you're sorry. He said, what amends have got to be about for you are stopping doing what you're doing, starting doing different things, and going to those people and say, what can I do to right the wrong? And as you think about it, that's a far step removed from saying you're sorry. Well, I started that process of cleaning house. I made amends to the kids, to Susan. Made a graveside amend to my father. Made amends to my mother. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and Step 8 and 9, well, the steps through 9, my relationships really, like Phoenix, began to rise from the ash heap of active alcoholism. I quit lying and stealing and chilling. You know what I'm trying to say. I quit cheating and stealing in my marriage. I quit cheating and stealing in my business. And things got better. Things got better in our house. I used to say to Louis, when will she really start to trust me? And he said, I don't know, but it'll be sometime after you become trustworthy and demonstrated that you're trustworthy. You know what? Essentially what you have tried to get me to do, you heard Bob say this, what you've tried to get me to do as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is to grow up and be responsible for the consequences of my behavior. You've not been totally successful at that, but that's what you've tried to get me to do. That's really what life has got to be about for me today, is to act like a grown-up. You know, I'm 67 years old, and some days it's hard as hell for me to act like a grown-up. But that's what life has to be about for me today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to talk to you about our kids a little bit. Things got better with Susan and I, and she got to the point with the help of her sponsor in the Al-Anon program where she forgave me for what had happened. And it was some time after I had become trustworthy. But our relationship has been like, you know, AA and Al-Anon, and AA's here and Al-Anon's here. We work the same steps. We have this special relationship. And we're like a set of railroad tracks, and we're this far apart. But when you stand in the middle of those tracks and look at the end, they come together. And that's what's happened to us. We've come together. The miracle of my life is my sobriety. The next miracle is the relationship I have with this woman that I love and live with. I made amends to the kids, and our daughter Linda was younger. She did not probably suffer the consequences of my alcoholism in terms of abuse as our son Steve had. And because of that, Steve was never, for a long time, able to accept my amends. I made them to him directly twice. I'm going to talk about Steve, and before I start, I've got to tell you this is a tragic story because Steve died. Steve died as a result of alcoholism and drug addiction. We became aware when he was in junior high that he had problems with drugs and alcohol. And we sought professional help for him, and he would get better. And then he'd get worse, and then he'd get better. And we got lots of help from AA and Al-Anon and the professionals in dealing with Steve. He was like his dad and his granddad before him, what my sponsor talks about today, Cliff. He was a functioning alcoholic. He functioned well. He was a brilliant kid. And he went through high school, and he got through college, and he ended up coming down to Miami and taking all the prerequisite courses for medical school, and went back to Boulder, Colorado, where he had graduated and went to medical school and became a medical doctor. His last year in medical school, he got into AA. And our relationship began to change because he began to live according to AA principles. He married a wonderful woman named Kate. They had a son named Sam. Our grandson today is 14 years old. And Steve accepted a residency at Duke, a rather prestigious university. And Kate and Sam were moving to Duke. He had a slip. He drank some beer. And he called up, and I said, you know, the rooms of AA are full of people who've had slips. Shake the dust off your feet. Get a new sponsor and come on back. And he did. He did just that. And things had been changing, you know. There was a time when he wouldn't talk to me. And now he called every week, and we talked. Steve died on August the 29th of 1993. And the week before he called, he'd call on Saturdays. Or he called on Sundays, and he called on Sunday, and Susan had gone to an Al-Anon service meeting. I was the only one home, and Steve and I talked for an hour and a half. We had the best talk in the 29 years that I was privileged to know him. And we talked about AA, and we talked about the steps, and that he was doing the steps. And he shared how difficult it was for him to come to a concept of God as he understood him. He talked about the fact that he'd lied when he had applied for his medical license, and how he had to, because of the house cleaning steps, he had to fess up to that and tell them that he had lied and he had a problem with drugs and alcohol. And they got him into the Impaired Physicians Program. He had a sponsor. He was well connected in Alcoholics Anonymous. His sponsor was Dave C. from North Carolina. And he asked when Susan and I could come down to Durham so he could make his amends to us. And I said, well, I've just been elected delegate, and I've got to go to the state conference, and then we'll fly down. And then he said, Dad, you've made amends to me twice. And I couldn't accept him. And he said, I want you to know that in every way I accept your amends. And I said, Steve, I want you to know, if this makes any sense to you, that before you make your amends to me, I accept them. And we told each other that we loved each other, and we hung up. And it's the last time I ever talked to him. I thought he was in such good shape. But alcoholism and drug addiction are cunning and baffling and powerful. And the next weekend, he worked a double shift back to back. And after his shift, he went to his on-call room in Duke University. He stirred up a concoction of synthetic opiates off prescriptions that he had illegally written, and injected himself in the ankle and went into respiratory arrest. They found him the next morning when he didn't make grand rounds. His heart was still beating feebly, but he had been without oxygen so long that his brain was dead. And we flew down there, and his sister came from California, and Linda and Kate, and made the decision that to turn off the life support systems, and we supported that. And we all stood there and held him as the lines went flat on the monitor. And when you look at this, it looks like he got a score this one, alcoholism and drug addiction 1 and AA 0. But as a member of AA and his daddy, I don't quite see it that way. Because as Casey said yesterday morning, we were current. Steve and his dad, Don, were current. We were okay. I'm not particularly religious. I go to church somewhat regularly because Susan asked me to go with her. I think that's a perfectly good reason. She went to hell and back with me. You know, the least I can do is go to church with her. But I do believe that in some way that I absolutely cannot comprehend on some spiritual plane, that I am going to get connected again with Steve. And the AA victory in this connection is that neither one of us is going to have to run up to each other and say, oh God, I'm so sorry. We got all that done because of the house cleaning steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're okay. And we're blessed. His wife, Kate, has remained close to our family. We have a close relationship with Kate and our grandson, Sam. Sam comes and spends time with us every summer. 14 years old and still wants to come spend time with the two of us. Our relationship with Linda has just been totally different. Kids are different. Kathy talked about it yesterday, how different our kids are. Linda it's just always been easy to have a relationship with her. She married a wonderful guy, a Jewish guy. She went to Cornell and then to Harvard Law School. She's a brilliant girl. She practices law in Washington, D.C. She's almost 40 years old and has a baby that's 4 months old and a son that's 3.5 years old. And we have a close relationship with Linda and her husband, Seth, and that family. Because it's only a two-hour plane ride from Naples to D.C., we get to see them a lot more often than we do the kids on the West Coast. So grateful for that. I told you that I've been involved in some illegal business practices, and when I read that first fifth step to my sponsor, I wrote a lot about that because I thought it was important for him to understand why it was necessary to break a few rules to make a living. I even stopped and said, "Do you understand about this?" He said, "I think I got it." He said, "You didn't need to write all that much about it. One word covers it all." And I said, "Really? And what would that be?" And he said, "It's called stealing and you got to quit." I was a contractor and I'd been involved in a process called bid rigging for quite a while. It took all the surprise out of opening the bids, you know. It was all... I didn't invent it, but I loved the easier, softer way. And when it was presented to me, I jumped right on board. So I quit. I went to those guys, the contractors, and I said, "Here's the deal. I'm trying to quit drinking, and I joined this thing called AA, and they tell me I got to quit doing this." And they said, "Well, we think it's a real good thing you're doing something about your drinking. And it sounds a little severe to us, but they were cool. They said, if this is what you got to do, go do what you got to do." So I didn't rig a bit from then till now. But Louis would say, this is the first part of the amends. You got to stop doing what you're doing. Got to start doing different things. And now you got to go to him and say, "I have harmed you. What can I do to right the wrong?" And he said, "When are you going to do that?" And I took refuge in the language of the step. I said, "But Louis, it says, except when to do so would injure them or others, and you can't rig a bid by yourself, so what am I going to do?" And he would just really get upset with me when I'd do that. And he'd say, "What does the book say?" And I said, "Oh, something about praying for the willingness until it comes." And then he said, "I suggest you get on your knees and start praying then." And I was doing some praying by this time. This was towards the end of my first year in sobriety. And I would get up in the morning and I would say, "Please help me stay sober today and thank him for my family and for AA." And then sometimes when I thought of it, I would say, "And by the way, God, it would be really nifty if you'd show me a way to clean up this bid rigging thing. Thank you and amen." And I'm here to tell you that you need to be real careful what you pray for, no matter how insincerely you pray for it. Because I guess God decided about that time I was a little slow in my ninth step, because he sent the Justice Department of the federal government to help me finish step nine. And about 19 other contractors in Kansas were indicted on bid rigging, and I was guilty of exactly what they said I was guilty of. And I, with the help of my sponsor and a lawyer, went to the prosecutor and said, "Okay, you got me. I did this, but you're going to have to figure out what other people did on your own. But I couldn't plead innocent when I was guilty." So they accepted my plea, and in the fall of 1981, not yet 2 years sober, I stood in front of a judge over in Kansas City, Kansas, in the federal courthouse, and it's still not my favorite part of town, I can tell you that. And pled guilty to a felony count of mail fraud and a felony count of violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And the judge said, "You got anything to say for yourself?" And I stole the line from you. I said, "Well, Your Honor, I believe my troubles are of my own making." And he said, "I sure agree with that." And he sentenced me to 6 months in the federal penitentiary and taught me my first important lesson about financial amends, and it's this: they do expect you to give the money back. Yeah, they want the money back. And he told me what the restitution would be. And I thought, there's no way I can do this. There isn't any way I can do this. But they did a thing, and maybe they still do it, they did a thing then called a pre-sentence investigation in the federal system, and they sent us home for about a month while the court system conducted this pre-sentence investigation. And we made a rather poor use of that time. We started staying up late at night watching old movies about life in hard-time prisons. And Susan developed a paranoia, and I developed a paranoia. She became absolutely certain they were going to kill me. And I became absolutely certain they were going to do something else to me. And I was sentenced to 6 months in the penitentiary, you know, and this is why I think it's so important to have an AA buddy. And I wrote inventory, and I talked to my sponsor about this, and the fear wouldn't go away. And one night I couldn't sleep. I went over to my buddy Kenneth's house, and he was an ex-dope dealer going back to college and sober. And he knocked on the door, and I was standing there bawling. And he said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "Oh, God, Kenneth, I'm going to prison." And he said, "You only got sentenced to 6 months." That didn't strike him as a particularly long sentence from his former profession. And he said, "They're going to let you out." And I said, "Yeah, but you don't understand what they're going to do to me." And he said, "What do you think they're going to do to you?" And I said, "Oh, God, Kenny, they're going to rape me." And he wasn't that polite. He just broke out into roaring laughter. He was rolling on the floor and laughing, and I'm jumping up and down and screaming, saying, "Oh, God, I just spilled my guts to you, and you're laughing at me." He got up and wiped the tears of laughter out of his eyes, and he looked at me and he said, "Don Popejoy, your ego knows no bounds." And I didn't get it. I didn't get it. I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Oh, look at yourself." He said, you're bald-headed, pot-bellied, and middle-aged. He said, "Baby, you ain't got what they want." And he was right. I did. And I went to prison, and AA was there. And something happened that cannot happen today. Because of the pre-sentence investigation and what the judge learned from my sponsor and his sponsor and a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, He gave me a court order parole after I was there 2 months, so I wasn't there hardly long enough to get my cot warm. And sent me back home, and we were essentially bankrupt. We had been disbarred from bidding on projects involving state or federal money. We'd taken a lot of money to get through the lawyer bills, and we were making this restitution. Restitution, let me tell you. They'd come up with this ridiculously big number of money that they wanted me to pay back. And I didn't have that kind of money. I didn't know where I was going to get that kind of money. It's really interesting. It was almost within a dollar or two of what Louis had me calculate that I had ripped him off. I don't know what they talked to him about. I don't know. And I said, okay. you know, I'll. What I did is I did what AA told me to do. One day at a time, I suited up, showed up, went to work, worked all day. And you know what? I found I was pretty good at building asphalt roads when I did that. And I asked the employees to stay with us. And finally, the government let us go back to work, start bidding on jobs. And that little company grew and prospered until 1996 when we sold the majority of it to a good family-owned company in Wichita. And that's how Susan and I moved to Wichita. I'd given a third of the company to the employees for their loyalty. And we walked away from that with a measure of financial security. Listen to those words I just said. That's what this weekend's been about for me. I've been saying it that way for a while. Maybe it was Bob that talked about the fact that after we're sober for a while, we kind of learn how to hide behind our sobriety, what's really going on with us. And I've been saying it that way for a while. Lee's heard me say that way a long time. I walked away with a measure of financial security. And the reason I've been saying it like that is because what I walked away with was a mountain of fear of financial security. I've had a job since I was 13 years old, a paycheck since I was 13 years old. When I was in the slammer, they paid me 50 cents an hour to shingle roofs. I mean, I've always worked. And we went to Wichita and sold the business, but I had a good job. These people gave me a really good job. They paid me a lot of money to do what I'd been doing for myself. And if you'd asked me at that time how much money we had in the bank, I said, I don't have any idea. Susan pays the bills. But let me tell you what I've done since retirement, since the paycheck stopped. I pay all the bills. I check our investment accounts about 3 times a day. I've become a miser because of the fear of financial insecurity. And if I told you sitting in this room how much money we've got to live on, you would tell me I'm absolutely insane. And you'd be absolutely right. And I sat there, right there, Friday afternoon and heard Bob Bazant say, I try to reduce life to a predictable, controllable process. And you know what I'm doing that? I'm trying to turn our golden years into our silver tarnished years. And my book tells me I got to do some things when I uncover something like this. It says, first of all, I got to continue to watch for fear and dishonesty and resentment and self-centeredness. And baby, this is a fear. And then it says I got to ask God to remove them immediately. And I got on my knees Friday night and did that in my room right here. And then it says I got to talk to someone about it. And you're my someone. And then it says, I got to go make amends if I've harmed anyone. And she's the one I'm going to go make amends to back in Naples, Florida when I get home. That's why I'm so grateful to be here. Back in Ulysses, Kansas, we didn't have a treatment center within a couple hundred miles. So we had to deal with a couple of doctors in the local hospital. And these two doctors would admit alcoholics and detox them in the hospital. And if the alcoholic was willing, they'd let us come up from the group during the night hours till six, from like midnight till 6 in the morning, and sit with that alcoholic. And we could make our pitch. And, you know, we could say we're there to try to help the nurses. But we'd make our pitch. And I put my name on that list. That's a lie. My sponsor put my name on that list to do that. And Bernie was hospital chairperson for our group. Bernie, who made amends to me. And the phone rang at about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was Bernie. He said, Don, there's a guy named Raymond up in the hospital. I need you to go up and sit with him 4 to 6. I said, Bernie, I have a business to run. I have to go to work. I can't do that. And he said, this list says Don Popejoy on it. He said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're not going to go, take your name on the list, but don't lie to AA. And Bernie was big. And I said, oh, God, don't make a federal case out of it. I'll go. So I went up there and met this other guy from the group, and we went down to Raymond's room. And Raymond was pathetic. Raymond's liver looked like a football under his skin. He was strapped into a bunch of IVs. And all I did for 2 hours was two things. I helped Raymond chase imaginary green dogs off his bed. And he had all these fluids running into him, and he was too proud to use the bedpan. And so about every 15 minutes, Jerry and I would get him up, follow him into the bathroom, wheel all these trolleys with fluids running out of them behind him, and help him go pee. And Raymond was in terrible shape and had terrible aim, and my shoes were wet and my fast legs were wet. And I thought, this is the dumbest thing I have ever done in my life. This guy's got nothing I want. He's a hopeless derelict of humanity, and he's going to die from this deal, and I'm down here wasting my time for 2 hours. And 6 o'clock came, the nurses told us we could leave, and I walked out to the car, and I was still smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and I opened the door of the car, and I lit a cigarette, and I looked up, and the birds were singing. Now, I'm not the kind of person that listened to birds sing. And I realized something, and I just started crying, and I had not shed a tear since 1968 when my dad died. And the reason I was doing that is because I thought, this is the dumbest deal. I have just spent 2 hours doing the last thing in my life I would ever do, and I've never felt this good before in my life. What a deal. In retrospect, I learned that morning the most important thing I've ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the next thought I had was, God, it's been a long time since I wanted to take a drink. You see, I became awake that morning. I couldn't have told you this at the time, but I'm so aware now that I became awake to the presence of God in the life, because I had just been doing what Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do, and for the first time in my life, I had gotten outside of myself and done something for another human being with no expectation of anything in return. Now, there was a process I went through to get to that point. The process of steps 1 through 9. And that couldn't have happened to me without going through the process of those steps. But I know for the first time ever, I was aware that God had come into my life and expelled the obsession to drink. A few years ago, I heard Sandy over in Tampa give his talk, The Spiritual Experience. If you haven't heard it, God, I recommend it. You know, our book says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I had never, till that moment, given any thought to a spiritual experience. And what I know today with every fiber of my being, that for all those years when I had tried to stuff booze and sex and money and property and power and prestige to fill this gaping hole in the middle of me, what was really going on is I was missing the hell out of God. And he came into my life that morning in that hospital parking lot because of the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I take those actions and do those things that you asked me to do, he's right there filling the hole, the perfect fit. And in the 12 and 12, it says, the great promise to me of AA. It says, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to be happily and usefully whole. And that's what you've done for me. You took this hopeless alcoholic, this gaping hole in the middle of his life, and showed me how to find the perfect fit with the God of my understanding. And I'll be forever grateful for that. Thank you for having me this week.